You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 26th of February 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London with me, Robert Bound. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, coffee growers in Colombia are on strike. We'll find out why and how long it might continue. German President Joachim Gauck made a passionate plea on Friday for greater European integration. Could a pan-European TV station unite Europe? We'll be asking what such a channel might look and sound like. And we'll be hearing how South Africa is playing to its strength when it comes to public health, utilising that great weather.
We live in a country where most people cannot afford to go to the commercial gyms, with a wonderful climate, huge outdoor spaces. We wanted to get back to gym in the outdoors.
Plus, we asked the author of a new book on smiling, why it pays to grin and bear it.
Others will have a more positive first impression of us if their first sight of us is of us smiling than if we're frowning or showing some other expression. Smiles also have the effect of reducing tension.
All that, plus we'll get the headlines from our New York bureau and we'll play a couple of great tracks too. All to come here on the next hour on Monocle 24. But first, at the top of the hour, it's news time with James Luckhurst.
Monocle 24 News. European politicians and markets have reacted nervously after Italy's general election produced a stalemate between centre-right and centre-left blocs. France and Germany urged continued reform, while Spain has described the results as a jump to nowhere. Italian markets fell sharply, while others in Europe and around the world were also down. Centre-right leader Silvio Berlusconi said fresh elections should be avoided and called for a period of reflection. The Obama administration has issued its strongest warning so far that the looming sequestration budget cuts will cause calamity for air travellers. Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood, a former Republican congressman, became the latest senior voice to express concern about the $85 billion sequestration cuts due to start on the 1st of March. The Federal Aviation Administration faces $600 million in cuts that will lead to the closure of dozens of control towers and the elimination of overnight shifts at others. He explained to Monocle 24 what this would mean for travelers.
What it means for Americans is that they could experience between 60 and 90 minute delays at major airports around the country, and to meet our safety standards so that flying continues to be the safest possible, planes will have to slow down, flights will have to be canceled, and the staging of flights in and out of airports will have to change.
Japan and the United States have called for the main UN Human Rights Forum to launch an inquiry into allegations of violations, including the torture and execution of political prisoners in North Korea. The reclusive country's network of political prison camps are believed to contain at least 200,000 people and have been the scene of rapes, torture, executions and slave labor, according to UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Navi Pillay. Japanese politician and human rights representative Toshiko Abe said in a speech to the Human Rights Council that Japan and the European Union would be submitting a joint resolution seeking an inquiry. Participants of talks on Iran's nuclear program held several meetings after the plenary meeting in Almaty today. The talks will continue on Wednesday, according to the European Union. Iran said it was prepared to make an offer to major powers after the United States proposed limited sanctions relief in return for a halt to the most controversial work. Michael Mann is the EU foreign policy chief spokesman.
The E3+3 presented its proposal this at 1:30 in the plenary. There was a discussion lasting about 2.5 hours. And then the Iranians went away to consider our proposal. There were further discussions during the course of the afternoon and the evening, and there will be another plenary tomorrow at which we hope we will get some more detailed feedback on our proposal.
The UK government has announced that servicemen and women who manned the Arctic convoy route between Britain and Russia during World War II would be recognised with medals. The announcement was overdue and richly deserved, according to UK Defence Minister Mark Francois.
These men in both categories, did great things for the defence of our country so that we can live in a free country, which we should never take for granted. And so I'm proud, I think the government's proud, from the Prime Minister downwards, to be honest with you, that I hope we have finally done the right thing. Within a few weeks we can start to give out these awards to surviving veterans and then to next of kin for people who so richly deserve them.
It's estimated that around 250,000 veterans and the families of those who've died could be eligible to receive the new award, according to the correspondence. Those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
Thank you, James. It's 18:05 here in London. That means you're tuned in to Midori House, coming to you live on Monocle 24.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 모노클 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London. 这是 Monocle 24.
Otlondo, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
You're tuned in to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One in London. Now, coffee growers in Colombia have gone on strike after demanding greater government support to protect them against a strong local currency and a 55% drop in prices over the past 2 years. Colombia is the world's fourth largest coffee supplier, falling just behind Brazil, Vietnam and Indonesia. The strike is indefinite and is likely to have a huge impact on the global coffee industry. Coffee growers have blocked streets and motorways in a number of towns, causing clashes with police. To tell us more about the situation is Mauricio Galindo, head of operations at the International Coffee Organization. Mauricio, welcome to Midori House.
Rob, hello. Thank you very much.
Now, the Colombian president has described this strike as unnecessary and inconvenient. Is it? What do most Colombians feel?
Well, I think there is certainly concern in the sense that prices have fallen dramatically, but it is also understood that this does not depend on anyone, certainly not the president of Colombia or the government or the Coffee Federation, to decide on prices. This is something that is set by the market, and it has been for the last 20 years. So in that sense, I can understand that there is very little that anyone can do to change what growers are being paid, as the government has already for quite a few years transferred directly what the New York price is paid. So in that sense, there is not much other than subsidies and help in helping them to grow more efficiently.
And we heard in the introduction there that Colombia is the fourth biggest supplier, amongst possibly some surprising names. We all know about Brazil, I guess, but Vietnam and Indonesia possibly are surprising names for listeners to hear as big coffee producers. Maybe is it those two latter names, Vietnam and Indonesia, that are putting prices down? Are they more competitive?
Well, what's happened is that there is certainly a very ample supplies coming from Vietnam. Vietnam has gone from 1 million bags back in the 90s to 24, perhaps 25 million bags currently. So there is certainly a lot of coffee being poured in the market. That being said, demand has been growing very, very vigorously for the past 10 years. I mean, we are expecting to continue from emerging markets to grow at about 5% a year, which obviously means there is a need for more coffee being put out there. But yes, there is certainly a feeling in the market that there are supplies, and that is inevitably giving a bearish sentiment.
And it seems like a strange conversation when I can smell coffee in the studio right now. It's clearly on every high street. It seems to be the most prevalent drink in the world, other than water itself. Are we in a kind of situation where there isn't actually enough coffee to go around? Is it going to turn into like a fish stocks debate in these countries such as Colombia?
Well, that is a very good question. There is certainly a certain threat, and particularly I would say from things like climate change, in the sense that especially the finest type of coffee, that one that grows at higher altitude, is certainly under, I wouldn't say threat, but we do have reasons to believe that there could be a serious problem in the long term if we don't tackle that. I mean, we have now an outbreak of coffee leaf rust in Central America that will knock down probably 20% of the crop for the next 2 or 3 years. So yes, we have to be careful that supplies are there. And that is why we think that at the International Coffee Organization, for instance, we encourage members to plan long term and to make sure that the institutions are there to help producers to withstand low prices, because we know that it's a question of time before more coffee is needed out in the market.
And presumably for a country like Colombia, which, as we say, is striking right now over coffee prices, any government, incoming, outgoing, or hoping to become elected, is keenly interested in keeping coffee farmers on side. They sound like the equivalent of French farmers, general agriculture farmers, right?
That is absolutely right. I mean, Colombia has an emotional attachment to coffee. I mean, even though in terms of foreign revenue, it doesn't represent what it used to, you have to bear in mind still, we think over 500,000 families live directly on coffee. That is probably 2.5 million people directly living from coffee. And so the social impact of coffee growing in Colombia is huge.
And how likely do you think that are the Colombian coffee farmers to get at least some of their demands seen to and heard?
Well, the government already announced that subsidies will remain in place probably until the end of the year. Originally, they were going to be only until July, and now it seems they might be extended all the way until December. So there is a certain, degree of listening to what they want to achieve. And I have no doubt that for the president, himself having been present here in London for quite a few years, directly at the International Coffee Organization, in fact, he knows very well the issues at heart of Colombia's economy. And just as I said, there is an emotional attachment to coffee. And so it's not something anyone could ignore.
He might just have a coffee bean tattoo.
You'll have to check on that one.
I think it's interesting for our listeners to know a little bit more about what you do, actually, Mauricio, at the International Coffee Organization. Are you interested, for example, in trying to find a more standard price for coffee, or at least fee paid to farmers for their coffee across, say, Vietnam, Colombia, Indonesia, and Brazil?
Well, the coffee prices were, up until 1999, were certainly regulated. There were export quotas that would be negotiated here in London and were actually very difficult to come to, but maintained price within a certain band. Those agreements that used to regulate, that were called economic clauses, were dropped in 1999. And then since then, we have a free market, complete free market for prices. So what we do, rather, is policy making. We try to find solutions for a bit of planning, advising, certainly having the best possible statistical work, suggest studies, sustainability, climate change. We're having next week our annual meetings here in London, where we're having a seminar on trends in consumption in new markets. We'll be analyzing climate change effect. We'll be debating trade barriers, basically every single aspect that makes the market function better, more transparent, more efficient, and hopefully more sustainable from an economic, from an environmental, and from a social point of view.
All right, well, while the blockades are still manned across Colombia, for the time being, Mauricio Galindo, Head of Operations at the International Coffee Organization, thank you very much for joining us. Coming up, we're going to ask what a pan-European TV station might look and sound like. Stay tuned.
Section D is the show you listen to for the untold stories, secrets and blazing headlines in the design sphere. The architects, fashion followers, artists and engineers who are making and breaking the trends across the world.
When Valentino touches the clothes, you see his hands tracing those lines of shape, form, and to see Valentino arranging one of his dresses is to understand the dress in terms of structure.
Join me, Hugo MacDonald, for an hour of insight, interviews and discussion every Tuesday at 1900 hours London time.
That's Section D with Hugo MacDonald, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
Ever thought of shaking off those golden handcuffs? Or had a daydream about going solo, striking out, far from the gentle plod of your day job? Then it's time you tuned in to The Entrepreneurs. Every week, we meet the brave, intrepid, sometimes audacious businessmen and women who have done just that.
What we're trying to do is not create a fragrance, but rather evoke something through scents.
It's a show that allows you to learn business nous by example. So, if you want to learn how to open a thriving organic bakery, patent a savvy invention, set up an artisanal microbrewery, or export a finely crafted product to the world. The Entrepreneurs, the living, working audio Bible.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time, in association with Pictet.
It's 1814, it's Monocle 24, it means you're tuned in to Midori House. Now, the question of greater European integration and how to convince the continent's increasingly sceptical population of its necessity is always an intriguing one. But how best to unite the citizens of the EU? Could one of the most potent tools of communication and social interaction play a role? Is it time for a pan-European TV station to bring people together? That's the view of the German president, for one, at least according to a high-profile speech he delivered last week. Our news editor, Tom Edwards, sets the scene.
In Berlin at the end of last week, there was a great deal of speculation about what the German president, Joachim Gauck, would have to say in his much-anticipated speech on the subject of his country's role in Europe and the whole European project. Gauck's words, carefully chosen as they needed to be given his supposedly apolitical status, provided plenty of interesting insight. At the heart of his address was the idea that the European Union lacks a canon of shared values, the kind of origin myth that helps to define successful nations. Gauck had some intriguing ideas of how the continent might make up for this collective shortcoming. One was the creation of a looser Commonwealth of Nations, including a public space for debate. A pan-European television station was the clearest expression of that idea. Gauck was very insistent that such a citizen-focused initiative would be one of the only ways to serve up more Europe to a population wary of what they perceive as elitist rhetoric. Could a Europe-wide TV service work? What would such a broadcast outfit even look like? And could it really serve the diverse mix of markets and media tastes that Europe represents? Gauck appeared to have little doubt that English would be the station's mother tongue. But was he even right about that? And even if the language were not disputed, from where should the European bloc draw its broadcast brilliance? These are tough questions for even the very best media minds to answer.
But fortunately enough, on Monocle 24, we have three of the best media minds around the table. Tyler Brulé, our editor-in-chief, Andrew Tuck, our editor, and Gillian DeBias, our head of TV. Welcome to Midori House.
Thank you.
What about you?
Well, I don't know. I need no introduction, literally. It's quite a nice idea, isn't it? I'm quite glad that President Stout put this thing out there for us to mull on. So we should break down the talent.
We should break down the talent, definitely.
In terms of where would this TV station be based? Where would its HQ be? Bureau throughout Europe, but where would its HQ be?
Well, I think it needs to be multipolar, and I like the idea, just as we do on Monocle 24, we tend to follow the sun. I think that we should definitely invite Istanbul into the mix. I think our morning should maybe start in Istanbul, would be a nice idea. Then perhaps we jump to Rome for lunchtime, and then we sort of maybe veer up north. But I like the idea that there's not one center of gravity, and maybe even the CEO and the programming directors, they have to pinball around the continent.
Yeah, because travel does broaden the mind, and there's not enough of that on the news.
It was
one of those funny things with the Pope's resignation, seeing Rome and now the Italian election, seeing Rome on the TV. It's really nice, having a kind of an attractive backdrop.
Absolutely.
Istanbul could do that
too. They have sunshine in Rome.
Exactly. Gillian, what about the aesthetics of this station? We could maybe start with news, as we're doing the news kind of now. How would you have it made up?
Well, I think they have to dump all the using the conventional people who do TV graphics, and they have to go to the heart of the schools and the graphic design schools at the best European graphic design schools to really get graphics that are going to speak. Because this is going to be a Tower of Babel, 27 different countries with languages all over the place. So graphics are going to be key. And I wouldn't go to all the professionals who are used to working in the media. I'd kind of tap into some of the really raw, great talent that they have, from Valencia to great graphic design schools in Paris, Czech Republic. You know, there are some great schools out there, so I'd work with them.
I think also maybe that instead of having we should co-opt the Swiss into it as well, so that because there'd be a nice neutral voice on news, and it's quite nice coming from the centre of Europe, the news.
And then
you could have a nice.
But would it be from Zurich or would it be from Geneva?
I think we'd have a train shuttling us between the two.
Oh man! You know how long that train ride takes. It'd have to be a helicopter.
It would be train news, I think.
but that's kind of the nub of the problem, isn't it? That even if we bring Switzerland into the mix, we're fighting over German and French and a bit of Romance, possibly.
Let's not leave out Italy.
I always say Romance in that way.
But I do think that Gauck is onto something, and we have Euronews, but it's not quite there, and Euronews doesn't really work. From my point of view, because there's no presenters, and it is, it just seems rather neutered, the whole thing. And then you've got something there which is great, Arte, but Arte is just a collaboration between the French and the Germans, but it's well loved in those two markets. And I think it could be very potent, because then you wouldn't have to wait for the likes of maybe the BBC to buy the rights to The Killing and all these types of things. It would just be there. It would be putting the best of Europe on television every night.
The only thing he's got to be careful of is that he hints at that kind of world of citizen journalism and doing things for the community. And those things always go really badly wrong. It's like all these nice community TV stations for cities. Yeah, they get small audiences. But once you start trying to be a bit do-goody about it and trying to force people to like each other, then it goes wrong. I think they should celebrate all the differences. You know, we should let Berlusconi bring on his ladies. And, they could do all the entertainment.
You're lobbying for the return of Eurotrash, hosted by Antoine de Caen, essentially. What about, how do we get the balance right between, we lauded the neutrality of Euronews, and we wrote in the current issue, the German-themed current issue, about Deutsche Welle, which certainly has that almost studied neutrality to it. And it's very high quality news, but it does have that. It has a certain patina to it. That, you know, I wonder where we'd get our ego from, where we get our bosses, and maybe some of our on-screen talent from.
Well, I think, as Andrew said, I think that the news at the core of this as well, and at a time when I think so many smaller European broadcasters, their budgets are definitely being squeezed, the idea of having these super bureaus, not just in Europe but around the world, I think the idea that, you know, many nations could pair up and also save money, but actually while also, you know, doing a better job at covering the entire planet would be a good thing. But I think it would be at the edges and where you'd be able to actually bring on, you know, the Berlusconi dancing girls, and you could have sort of, you know, great opinion. And, you know, there is that horrendous melange of European television, as we often see in Eurovision. But, you know, but of course, we love to hate it, but we all gather around it. And I'm sure that this is a big part of it. They talk about, you know, this notion of a broadcasting agora. And I agree with Andrew. Heaven forbid that it becomes, you know, this font for citizen journalism. I don't think that would be the right way to go. But I think could you have some of the more cringy elements that we sort of secretly like, I think should be a part of it. And that's where the debate and the friction could lie.
Well, that's why they have to be so careful. It's not just interview and studio based. So, you know, they say they want common values, but they just have to diversify. So there's humor, and they can't be scared of humor. And there have to be films and sort of tap in onto their local filmmaking community, because often budgets, those are the first that are going to be cut. But if you have lots of local bureau, you can pull in your filmmakers.
Maybe we should turn it on our heads. Maybe the Swiss and the Germans should do all the humor. You know, we think we're so good here in the UK and the BBC and all the rest of it, and that back catalogue of great stuff, and the Scandinavians are wonderful at sort of like noirish drama, but we should maybe switch it all in its head and just only watch sort of, you know, Spanish drama.
Well, I think also rather than having, you know, wonderful, very slick, you know, pre-recorded stings going to break, why shouldn't there be an Oompa-Pa band that just does it live? That maybe they're there 24, or, you know, or maybe you have Oompa-Pa 8 hours of the day, you know, and then maybe you have Fado or something else in the afternoons. Yeah. You know, I think that would work. And I think it needs that sense of liveness as well.
That, to paraphrase Lady Gaga, that does sound like Bad Romance. and I guess this idea of some of the lowest common denominator stuff, Berlusconi's dancing girls and stripping housewives and all the rest of it, would that have any place, or would that just be the kind of...
No, I think we should have...
Because nighttime is almost the same time throughout Europe, isn't it?
Yeah, and we should have the Greek chat show, you know, where they kind of punch each other when things go wrong. I think that'd be quite nice.
That's Parliament TV.
Okay.
That's not a game show.
But there is that bizarre thing, don't you think? I was thinking that, you know, here in the UK, that, you know, we really don't look at Europe. We don't look what's happening across the border. You know, even if the weather, you know, people may have homes in France, they may be travelling there for the weekend, but you never see the weather forecast to tell you what the weather's like in Paris. They'll kind of dwell on the Shetlands, where there's like three people, but they'll never tell you what's going on in Paris.
I think we should. This could run and run, but we're going to have to leave it there. But the bottom line is possibly that we should just do it.
I think that's a great idea.
I think we can lobby him. Have you got his email address?
Well, I do. I think we almost have enough nationalities here as well to round the whole thing out.
I think we can.
I'm almost feeling a sting. A Midori voice is coming on.
Here we go. Side of Relay, Andrew Tuck and Gillian De Bias. Thanks very much for joining us. Coming up next, a trip to New York.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv
to Buenos Aires
to Toronto,
to Amsterdam,
all around the world, this is Monocle 24.
Time now to cross the Atlantic and hear what's making headlines in New York City. Joining me on the line is Monocle's associate editor, Barrett Austin. Barrett, welcome to Midori House.
Hello, Rob.
So what's been going on? You've done like the Mikado does and drawn up a little list for us. You wanted to talk about sexy Republican lawmakers, didn't you?
Oh, well, that's something that always gets me excited. It's something that I like talking about, especially during the lunch hour here in New York. But yeah, to sort of follow off of that, there is a story that's just come out. A number of prominent figures within the Republican Party have signed a legal brief, which will be submitted to the Supreme Court in favor of gay marriage. This is an issue that has essentially been a non-issue for Republicans up to this point. So, you know, I don't think it necessarily signals that any sort of change is imminent on the front lines for Republicans. But it at least shows that the party is starting to think about the issue.
And I mean, is this the changing of the tide, or is this the Republicans sort of grapple onto some form of sort of public support, get on and try and make friends with at least a few of Obama's voters?
I think from the perspective of the law as we see it, I don't think it's something that we're really going to see that much change. But at the same time, the issue of gay marriage, it's just something Republicans haven't thought a whole lot about. And I think this last election really gave an indication that it is something that most Americans are, in fact, thinking about. I was reading something recently that the Republican Party presidential candidates have lost the popular vote in 5 out of the last 6 elections. So, I mean, that just goes to show that the party is very much out of touch with most Americans. Polls suggest that as many as 70% of American voters in the last election under the age of 30 are, in fact, of Republican voters in the last election are, in fact, in support of gay marriage. So I think the party is sort of finally coming to the terms with the fact that the issue of gay marriage in America is very, very important. And it's not just one of those generational issues that's just going to be washed out.
And what sort of personalities have attached themselves to this? Are there any surprising Republican names?
Well, first of all, I was interested when I first read that a number of President George W. Bush's top legal advisors have attached themselves to it. But beyond that, there are two people who stick out in particular to me. One is Meg Whitman, who is the CEO of Hewlett-Packard out in California. She's a Republican who ran for governor in the state. She lost. But when she was running, she sort of stood in favor of Proposition 8, which was a ballot issue, which prevents same-sex couples from marrying in California. So it's quite important, I think, that she is now signed on and has agreed to support the issue. Another, I think, even more importantly, is John Huntsman, the former governor of Utah, who ran for president in 2012. At that point, he was in favor of same-sex civil unions, but opposed to gay marriage. He's really the first Republican presidential figure who's entered the space, who's willing to sort of breach the issue. So I think that's important, because what that means is that assuming John Huntsman might run for president in 2016, it'll be the first time that the issue of gay marriage really is on the platform of the Republican Party.
All right, Barrett, in a seamless change of pace and topic, we're going to talk about the Harlem Globetrotters visiting North Korea. Dennis Rodman, a man with the most amazing hair in the NBA. They've just rocked up there, right?
Yes, I can't think of a better story to follow off of that.
No.
Dennis Rodman, of course, was one of the great Chicago Bulls players in the 1990s. He's remembered, firstly, for being a decent basketball player, but more importantly, he had green hair, he had yellow hair, he had cheetah-striped hair. So anyway, this Dennis Rodman, along with the Harlem Globetrotters, have gone over to North Korea. They're in Pyongyang now, in what's being called a bit of sports diplomacy. All of this is a bit funny because, you know, it all seems a bit silly, but there is some sort of connection there in the sense that the current supreme leader of North Korea is, in fact, a big fan of the Chicago Bulls. So whether or not this really means anything for sake of diplomacy, there is that funny connection there.
That's an odd one as well. Also, North Korea, I think there's only 14 legal hairstyles, which is an added irony to that.
I think so. I think any of the things that Dennis Rodman was famous for in the U.S. are, in fact, illegal in North Korea.
I think they probably are. And we're going to switch it up again. The sequestration. Why do I find this so difficult to say? Debate marches on in Washington. This is the Defense Department and cuts and things. Tell us a little bit about this, Barrett.
Well, it's not just sort of pertaining to the Defense Department. Of course, we have cuts across the board in Washington, D.C. that we're going to see take effect this Friday, assuming there is no 11th hour solution to this. But the Defense Department in particular is really worried because just over the next couple of months, they're going to see as many as nearly $50 billion in funding cut to the Defense Department. Over the next decade, it's as much as $500 billion that's being cut. These cuts reduce the amount of money that they have to go to new equipment, to training, to all the various military installations across the country and abroad. But yeah, the Joint Chiefs of Staff met before the House of Representatives today to give sort of a final pitch, giving the idea that, you know, these cuts, they simply cannot be afforded by the defense community, and that should the U.S. end up withdrawing as much as $500 billion from the Pentagon over the next decade, that, you know, the U.S. will not be able to protect itself.
Barrett, thank you so much for joining us. He's the man that can turn topic on the change of a sixpence, on the turn of a sixpence, possibly. We call him Barrett Austin. He's our associate editor in New York. Thank you very much. Coming up next is news time. And at 18:30, the bottom of the hour, it's time for the news headlines with James Luckhurst.
European politicians and markets have reacted nervously after Italy's general election produced a stalemate between centre-right and centre-left blocs. France and Germany urged continued reform, while Spain described the result as a jump to nowhere. Italian markets fell sharply, while others in Europe and around the world were also down. The Obama administration has issued its strongest warning so far that the looming sequestration budget cuts will cause calamity for air travellers. Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood, a former Republican congressman, became the latest senior voice to express concern about the $85 billion sequestration cuts that are due to start on the 1st of March. Japan and the United States have called for the main UN Human Rights Forum to launch an inquiry into allegations of violations, including the torture and execution of political prisoners in North Korea. The reclusive country's network of political prison camps are believed to contain at least 200,000 people and have been the scene of rapes, torture, execution and slave labour, according to UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Navi Pillay. Participants of talks on Iran's nuclear program held several meetings after the plenary meeting in Almaty today. The talks will continue on Wednesday, according to the European Union. And the UK government has announced that servicemen and women who manned the Arctic convoy route between Britain and Russia during World War II would be recognised with medals. The announcement was overdue and richly deserved, according to UK Defence Minister Marc Francois. Those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
All right, thank you, James. Time for a track now. This is a new one from Villages, a slightly confusingly plural name for the man that is Conor O'Brien. Villages came in for my culture show to perform a Midori House session last week. From that is this, Nothing Arrived.
Savannah scatters and the seabird sings. So why should we fear what travel brings? What were we hoping to get out of this? Some kind of moment, airy bliss. I waited for something, and something died. So I waited for nothing, and nothing arrived. It's our dearest ally, it's our closest friend, it's our darkest blackout, it's our final end. My dear sweet nothing, let's start anew. From here on in, it's just me and you. I waited for something,
something died. So I waited for nothing, and nothing arrived. Well, I guess it's over. I guess it's begun. It's a loser's table, but we've already won. It's a funny battle. It's a constant game. I guess I was busy when nothing came. I guess I was busy.
And that was the haunting sound of Villagers with Nothing Arrived. And that's on the current culture show, which you can hear. I guess you can Google it and you can find it anywhere. But why don't you listen to it on monocle.com? And you're back with me, Robert Bounds, on Midori House. It's 1836 here in London. Now, a new book out a couple of weeks ago aims to assess the mindset of Eastern Europe after decades of totalitarian rule. What does it do to people? How do you deal with a lack of freedom? What are the contemporary repercussions? Joining me now is the author, Marcy Shaw, and she's the book is The Taste of Ashes, The Afterlife of Totalitarianism in Eastern Europe. And she's on the line to quite possibly answer a few of those questions. Marcy, welcome to Midori House.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Oh, you sound exceptionally clear on the ISDN from New York. It's like you're just sitting across the table from me there. I wanted to ask you, first of all, communism fell in 89. That's the sort of popular myth. But I guess one of the things that your book explores is that it obviously has an afterlife and a resonance far beyond the years of its sort of breakdown.
Yes, the book is very much about the way in which the totalitarian past lingers in the present, which does not mean that it's a book about, you know, why there is still communism in Eastern Europe. It's a book about the presence of the past and the book about the impossibility of closure and the impossibility of making the past okay. Well, back in the mid-19th century when Marx and Engels published the Communist Manifesto, they begin it with that legendary line, a specter is haunting Europe, the specter of communism. Now, at that time, that specter was a specter to come. It was a specter from the future. But one of the things I argue in the book is that communism as a specter from the past is no less haunting.
And it is. It's one of those things. It is the most, and it's a line that almost gives you a shiver down the back of your neck. Did you find this spectre to be in rude health on your travels through Eastern Europe, researching and writing the book?
Yes, and again, not in the sense that, you know, there are communist revolutionaries there plotting a takeover, but more, I would say, in a certain kind of Freudian sense. I mean, I'm a historian, and I've spent nearly two decades hanging around Eastern Europe working in the archives, and there was very much a feeling in 1989 that censorship would be lifted, that the archives would be open, that everybody would bask in the light of truth and live happily ever after. But it turns out that in the great battle for the truth of the human condition between Marx and Freud, where Marx promises us happily ever after, and Freud does not, that Freud was right. Because, you know, for Freud, the unconscious was a kind of a dark psychic closet into which everything too disturbing for the conscious mind was thrown. The Communist Party archives were basically the Freudian unconscious. That was that dark psychic closet into which everything too disturbing for the conscious mind was thrown. And, you know, Freud, for his part, had no illusions that when you start coaxing the contents of that dark psychic closet into consciousness, that it would be pleasant. And it's been enormously painful.
And it's an interesting thing mentioning Marx and Freud, two people whose oeuvre came from central, if not Eastern Europe, and whose thinking and pervaded the whole world after that. Why was Eastern Europe such a centre for this sort of intellectual outpouring, I suppose, in the late 19th century?
Oh, that's a wonderful question. Well, Freud, of course, comes from Vienna, you know, in the late 19th, early 20th century, which was a kind of extraordinary place to be. I mean, and I love Vienna to this day, but I still feel sometimes in Vienna that Vienna is kind of nostalgically basking in the light of, you know, what it had been, you know, 120 years earlier at the Fondiasek. And I mean, part of the reason, I mean, there are different reasons in each case. I mean, Vienna was a wonderfully cosmopolitan place. The late 19th century was a certain kind of late 19th, early 20th century, a certain last moment of imperial cosmopolitanism before there was a certain kind of breakup into nation states in Eastern Europe with more rigid boundaries, when there was still a very richly kind of multilingual and very much on the move kind of intellectual class. And ideas were flowing in a way that I think intellectuals have always been nostalgic for since that time. And Milan Kundera, for instance, has much nostalgia about the Habsburg Empire.
And I wanted to ask you, before we go, I wanted to ask you a couple of direct questions, Marcy. I wondered if there's a psychology that's unique to Eastern Europe, post-communist Eastern Europe, I should say.
Well, I wouldn't want to essentialize and say there's a psychology that was unique. I would say one of the things, I mean, for me, Eastern Europe is a certain kind of a prism in which, you know, the heart of the 20th century European experience, totalitarianism, was experienced much more intensely in Eastern Europe than in Western Europe. There, in places like Poland and Ukraine and Belarus, the experiences of Nazism and Stalinism were truly intertwined. And so people were subjected to these extreme circumstances. And there's a line by the Polish poet Wisława Szymborska: "We know ourselves only insofar as we have been tested." So people were forced to make decisions in extraordinarily difficult situations. And then after 1989, they were forced to account for those choices in a world literally in which all the rules have changed. I mean, and one of the great tragedies was there were moments of historical extremity in which there were no innocent decisions to be made, in which all significant action involved a betrayal of someone or something, in which all possible choices caused suffering. Nevertheless, one had to choose. And what's happened after 1989, when one has to account for those choices, seems to me a kind of a particular human drama, you know, the kind that you get in the great novels where the intensity of human experience is kind of condensed, you know, through the experiences of the protagonist who kind of live great, great loves and great betrayals and great intimacies, you know, and great idealisms, great disillusionments. And that to me is what's so dramatic about Eastern Europe, not because for some kind of, you know, ethnic reason those people are different, but because the experience of totalitarianism was so particularly viciously intense there.
Marcy, I wish we could talk about this a bit more, because the last question, I think we're going to have to email you, but never mind. It's a fascinating read, and I guess it's where memoir and fiction, in a way, and history all come home to roost. The author was Marcy Shaw, and the book is The Taste of Ashes, The Afterlife of Totalitarianism in Eastern Europe. You're tuned in to Midori House. Coming up, we're going to take a trip to the open-air gyms of South Africa, and we're also going to ask the author of a new book on smiling, why it pays to grin and bear it. But first, this is 100 Yard Dash by Raphael Sadiq. Pretty good. It's 100 Yard Dash by Raphael Sadiq. You're tuned in to Midori House. The time is 18:45 here in London. South Africa has a sporty start of the new year with the Africa Cup, and for the upcoming years, the country's government has increased its healthcare budget. Still, entrepreneurs see themselves as the ones responsible for coming up with initiatives to battle South Africa's increasing health problem, obesity. Saskia Houghton paid a visit to Cape Town's very first gym in the open air.
Being outside is great. It's good for your heart. It's good. Help you de-stress, help you relax, help you get some perspective, help you think. No, it's really, really good.
In Cape Town, South Africa, fitness has never been so cheap and sunny. Paul does his morning workout at the Cape's very first outdoor gym. It's a fitness room, but accessible for free and in the open air in front of the Sea Point Promenade. Elaine is also a frequent visitor.
I come here for 5-10 minutes, just do a bit of muscle toning, because I'm 68, so I got to keep moving. I do that turn, and I do the stepping, and then I do a lot of climbing. It's just a routine that breaks the normal muscles of just moving. I try and do something extra to add a little bit more to the bone mass.
Cape Town's first outdoor gym opened over a year ago and was initiated by Play on Art. This initiative has a national vision of getting both the private and public sector to work on health and fitness issues in South Africa. Ross Rubenstein is one of the initiators.
We live in a country where most people cannot afford to go to the commercial gyms, with a wonderful climate, huge outdoor spaces, and wonderful opportunity to have a gym which in essence is green. Getting away from the commercial gyms, which are huge consumers of water, electricity in its various forms, we wanted to get back to gym in the outdoors.
All gym pieces were developed by local engineers, health experts and designers. Designed with South Africa's wildlife in mind, the outdoor gym reflects this country's famous animals.
We've got a large range of about 18 different pieces which address all aspects of physical fitness, from strength training to flexibility, cardiovascular and general fitness. So it encompasses pieces which will address all these different areas. We wanted it to be a uniquely South African product, and we designed it on the basis of our wildlife. So each piece has a spin on a different animal. So we've got a zebra, an elephant, a hippo, a rhino. If you look at the pieces, you will see this in the design. There is something that reminds you of the animals. Each piece is accompanied as by an information board, and the information board will say Songololo, rhino, hippo. This has been a very wonderful aspect of our product development, that people have really responded to the uniqueness of these pieces, unlike the pieces which are just supplied by China around the world.
South Africa is one of the world's fattest countries. In a community where HIV/AIDS and TB is still the health ministry's priority, obesity is a silent killer. According to a survey in 2010 by pharmaceutical multinational GlaxoSmithKline, 61% of the South African population is overweight, obese, or morbidly obese. And that's a very serious problem, explains Dr. Zandile Mshiza, a specialist on obesity at South Africa's Medical Research Council.
We have this stability of culture. We believe, like in the black community, that we believe a Chabia woman is the most attractive one and the most fertile one. Whereas there's also this stigmatization in terms of like those people who suffer from tuberculosis or HIV and AIDS. And now people are afraid to lose weight because of that. The minute you lose weight, even if you do it consciously, you do it voluntarily, then people think you are sick. Obesity is a big problem here in South Africa, and it affects not only adults, but now it's affecting younger children.
With skyrocketing obesity figures, the South African community raises concerns for the next generation. Outdoor gyms are not just for fun. Initiatives like these are a necessity, as explains Ross Rubenstein.
Well, the next step is we've expanded the concept. There is a concern about the lifestyle diseases that we have here in South Africa that could be prevented to a large degree if we address things like nutrition and physical fitness. We are concentrating very hard on schools this year because of the great problems of obesity and lifestyle diseases which are found with children in South Africa. So from schools to parks, the whole idea behind our company is to provide free and accessible gyms to South Africans. And furthermore, if I can just add that with our consultations with health economists here in South Africa, it is absolutely clear that the money is more economically spent on prevention rather than cure at a later stage.
And for some people like Albert, the gym can also be just a nice way to deal with boredom.
If I don't have nothing to do at home, I always come here and exercise myself, keep myself busy.
each and every time, yeah.
For Monocle in Cape Town, I'm Saskia Houten.
It's 18:51 in London and you're tuned in to Midori House with me, Robert Bound. Why smile? That's the question that's the question author Marianne Lafrance poses in the title of her newly released book, all about facial expressions. From innocent grins to malicious smirks, Lafrance explores the science behind those upturned corners. She even identifies the smiliest parts of the globe. Our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, who himself is never without a smile, asks Marianne her own question. Why do we smile?
The answers are incredibly varied. One of the things for me that's interesting about smiling is that there are multiple reasons, multiple situations, multiple psychological underpinnings of it. So wherein we might say, why do people frown? The number of answers would be extremely limited. It would be circumstances that are distressing, upsetting, frustrating in some respect. But smiling, we smile when we're happy. But we also smile when we're sad to cover that we're sad. We smile when we're embarrassed. We smile when we're angry but don't want to let others know. So in short, the answers to why smile are almost as varied as the social circumstances in which we find ourselves.
Absolutely. And I want to ask as well, I mean, when you smile, of course, there's some the consequences as well. Do you know what are the consequences of our smiles? What does our smile cause in other people?
Well, among other things, smiling affects what other people think of us. So one of the things we know through lots of studies is that others will have a more positive first impression of us if their first sight of us is of us smiling than if we're frowning or showing some other expression. The effect that we have on others is also a contagion effect. So if I'm smiling, it is much more likely that you will mimic my smile. You will adopt the smile that you see so that you end up feeling more positive, more optimistic, more open-minded than if I didn't smile. Smiles also have the effect of reducing tension. There's an example you may recall from the book in which at the beginning of the Iraq war between the U.S. and Iraq, the armed forces were entering the town of Najif, and the residents of the town were congregating in apparently not exactly positive model. And the commander told his soldiers to point their guns down and to smile. And that apparently had a direct result. People just kind of basically relaxed in what was an otherwise tense and growing tense situation.
Is it also some sort of survival tool? Like, I'm talking clearly here about babies, for example.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, one of the things that I think the data on babies really shows very strongly is beginning with the data that finds that babies smile in the womb. And it's clear that they're not smiling in the womb because they're deliriously happy to be there, although they might think it's pretty neat for the time being. But it is a reflex action that we as a species have to have at our disposal from day one so that we can secure loving, caring, attentive caregivers, because humans take so long to reach the level in which we can take care of ourselves. Therefore, we need other people to take care of us. And there are few things more effective than a baby's smile in securing the love and attention and commitment of caregiving adults. And that's true through most of our lives.
And finally, Marianne, I just would like to for our international audience, to look at smiles globally. I mean, are there countries that smile more than others? Because I know, for example, you mentioned in your book that, for example, in Northern Europe, people actually, they just smile for people they know, not for strangers, which wouldn't happen in a Latin country, for example.
Right. Well, the wonderful thing about culture and smiling is that culture affects how much we smile and the circumstances under which we smile and the intensity or vibrancy of the smile. So you're absolutely right. I mean, countries differ in the degree to which smiling is taken as something that you do only with people that you know, that you're familiar with, that you're close with, and you would never think of smiling at someone you did know, it would be regarded as silly. And I know, having spent time in Europe, that people in various parts of, whether France or the UK or Spain or Italy, think Americans are just dopey because they smile so much.
Oh, Brazilians as well.
Yes.
I'm Brazilian, so.
Yes, yes. Well, I mean, I think, you know, we are raised to smile in a certain way and with a certain degree of openness to people that we do and do not know, and we take it as natural. So Americans can't imagine why you would not smile at a stranger, whereas people in France would think, what? What are you thinking? Smiling at someone you don't know? What crazy thinking is that? So there are a lot of variations, and there's also variations in how smiling is done. So, for example, moms in the U.S., are very pleased when their babies not only look happy, but are kind of show enthusiastic happiness. They're gurgling, they're moving, they're laughing, they're cooing. Whereas moms in Japan, for example, want their babies to be happy, just like American moms want their babies to be happy, but they want the happiness that their babies show to be calm, to be very relaxed and non-energetic, calm. So, you know, the cultures differ in what is it we want to see on the faces of people that we see all the time, and what do we regard as natural and normal. And that's why intercultural encounters sometimes are so interesting, because what we take is natural and normal and the way things are done, when we encounter people who smile what we think of as too much or don't smile at all, we then make all kinds of attributions about them being promiscuous, or they're being emotional, or they're being unemotional and automatons or something of that order. So we make a lot of attributions about people from different countries based on how ready they are to smile, how big they smile when they do, what circumstances they regard as appropriate to smile, and what circumstances they would not be caught dead smiling and would think it would be offensive if they did smile.
And that was Mariana LaFrance talking to Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco. And that's all we have time for today. Thanks to our producer, Dawn Trump, our researchers, Fernando Augusto Pacheco again, and Edward Lucas, and our studio manager, Alex Funnell. Next up is Section D, and at 2000 hours, Emily Aelitz will be here with The Pacific Shift Live, with highlights of the day and music from our global playlist. Hugo McDonald will be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. For the time being, from me, Robert Bound, thanks for tuning in.